Our first speaker this morning is Billy Delp, one of our board members and a past president. He, as he said, is during his term, he came up with the idea of doing the development fund, which we do hope to put to good use one of these days. He has just completed a book on the Hartsook family, and in working on the book and doing the background research, which we know is a very important part of genealogy, it's not just the names and the dates, he came across a lot of information about how South Carolina was sold in Europe, the idea of migrating to South Carolina. So that's the topic of his talk this morning, and give him a big hand.
Thank you. It's good to be with you to talk a little bit about our Orangeburg folk. But before I start, I'd like to tell you this little story. As I understand it, it was in the early 1900s, the president of Harvard University was on a tour, and he went out west to Kansas to give a speech. And that was before the days of motels and hotels in these small towns. And he was staying with one of the local families. He was to spend the night and leave the next morning going somewhere else. And, of course, they were excited and to have this dignitary stay with them. And the lady of the house got friends, and they cooked this fabulous feast for him so he would have a nice supper, dinner that evening. And so as they were eating, they noticed that he was just sort of picking at his food. You know, the old expression, eating like a bird. He was not really eating. Yeah. And he finally noticed that they were noticing him, and he said to them, I don't speak well after having a big meal. And so they passed it off. Well, that night after the speech, his bedroom was right next to the couple that he was staying with, and it had these thin, uninsulated walls, and he could hear everything they were saying. And so the lady of the house said to her husband, "How did you like the speech?" And the husband said, finally, he might as well have been. Okay, the title of my talk is Y'all Come, Early Marketing of South Carolina. And you know, today we're bombarded with marketing. We ride down the highway and we see billboards selling something. We pick up the Sunday newspaper, and if we have a bad back, it's irritated by just getting it into the house because we've got several pounds of marketing advertisements. You turn on the television, and at every break, you're bombarded with not one ad, but several strung together. Too many, we think. And then you go on the internet, or the cell phones, or Facebook, or anything, and you know, you have a lot of free stuff on the internet if you put up with the ads that you have. So, what I want you to do now is to forget all of that and think with me about the early 1700s and what means of communications they had to promote something or to sell something. And what was it? Primarily written communication. And not only that, to send something to Europe was an 8 to 12 week journey each direction. So, you know, you get the message over there in one quarter, and the end of the next quarter you get an answer back. So that was communication in those days. Now, before I really dig into that any further, we need to talk about the first part of my title, Y'all Come. Now, I'm going to give you my theory about the development of that word. Maybe you shouldn't quote me to English teachers and all, but anyway, this is my version. You know, in the South, y'all is a part of a language. I mean, there's no question about it. You don't even bother to ask. You know, it's just there. Well, Southern folks were responsible for that word, you know. And I suspect the German Swiss were involved in that too. Their descendants. You will recall that the Old English used thou and thee for the first person, right? What they used for the second? Ye. That is kind of awkward. But somebody didn't like it, you know, some of the English types, and they decided that you would substitute for both, first person and second person. Well, the Southern folks, especially those descended from the German Swiss, were too logical and intelligent for that. They didn't buy that. They said, you's okay for the singular, but not for the plural. We're going to give you a substitute, and it's y'all. Now, that was accepted pretty well. And in many states, it's common. But, you know, that's part of our country where, you know, I don't know if it's lower intelligence or what, but they don't accept that. You know, they use other things. And in fact, one part of the country, they tried to use it, but it ended up as something like use. So they don't even have it right. Anyway, that's enough of that. We'll talk about marketing now. Let's look at a brief history of immigration in this country. And we can start with Jamestown in 1607 and Plymouth in 1620. And those residents were primarily English. And it stayed that way for the next 50, 70 years, mostly English coming to America. But by 1680, a guy named William Penn, that we've all heard of, from Pennsylvania, he wrote a pamphlet himself and commissioned several others, or there were others written, and we think he commissioned them. And these were distributed in Germany, and it was pamphlets promoting Pennsylvania. So remember that year, 1680. So what was happening in South Carolina was 40 years in the future. And they attracted people to Pennsylvania based on these pamphlets, well ahead of anything happening in Charleston. Charleston was not founded until 1670. And it was primarily English initially, and then people began to trickle in people of all nationalities. French Huguenots came into Charleston before the Germans, and that's another story of its own, is the study of the French Huguenots. So we have Charleston started in 1670, and by the early 1700s, they have around 6,000 people in the Charleston area. And so things were going very, very slow as far as immigration is concerned. But over in Europe, in 1706, a small pamphlet was prepared and began to be distributed it was attributed to a pastor by the name of Joshua Cockerthal. There's speculation about whether or not he really wrote it and whether that was his real name and all of that, but let's give him credit for writing it. But he had a picture of Queen Anne of England on the front, and the title pages, the lettering, was in gold, which apparently was unusual in those days, and it became known as the Golden Book. It had a glowing report of Carolina. Before that, everything was Pennsylvania. It contained, its subtitle was A Complete and Detailed Report of the Renowned District of Carolina in English America. That was it. That was the real title. There was no evidence that the author had ever been to America. It surmised that he collected information from other writings and published his book. He described the government, the land, the commerce, and he mentioned some Europeans living in America, in Carolina. He praised Carolina for low taxes, lack of the feudal system, religious freedom, and he said it was a much better place to immigrate than Pennsylvania, because it was not as cold. Now, the key thing about his book is he implied that the English government would pay the passage to Carolina and maybe provide some money. Well, the government had not decided to do any of those things, but it was implied, not stated, but people read it as if it were true. He recruited 41 Germans 2 years later and took them to England and sought government assistance to move them to America, to Carolina. He finally got agreement for the government to pay the passage. And where did they send them? New York. Not Carolina. So nobody came to Carolina immediately based on his book. But the word got out that the English had paid for them to go. That was 1708. The very next year, Germans began moving in a flood to Rotterdam. And they said, "Why are you here?" And they said, "We want to get to England so they'll send us to America." And they didn't have money to get to England, and the government, the Rotterdam people and charities and the English government ended up moving some 15,000 to England. And then the English had to decide what to do with them. And so they were camped out in tent villages all over the place. Well, the first thing they did is they queried them about their religious faith. 2,000 were identified as Catholics. They sent them home. That was the attitude in those days. And others were sent to different places. Some were sent to Ireland. I didn't realize they were immigrating into Ireland at that time. Others were sent to New York, New Jersey, and North Carolina, but none to Carolina from that group, South Carolina. It raises the question of why. Why was it was happening everywhere else, but not in South Carolina? If you remember, the Lord Proprietors were granted the right to develop Carolina in 1663. So we're talking about 50 years that they'd had this. Some of the original Lord Proprietors had died and had substitutes by this time. They were granted the rights to develop this area called Carolina. And do you know what area that included? All of the present states of Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and everything to the west. One thing I read that they said that no one has found the western boundary yet. By 1720, North Carolina had been separated from South Carolina, that each had their own governor. And the Lord Proprietors did have policies to promote immigration, but it was not a very strong one, and there were a lot of negatives about the Lord Proprietors' leadership. For example, they were determined to set up an aristocracy similar to England. where they gave, you had these large holdings, land graves, and different titles based on the land holdings. And the General Assembly of South Carolina proposed a constitution on several different occasions that everybody was basically treated equal and none of that dukes and so forth titles, and they never would approve it. And so there was really a lot of animosity toward the Lord Proprietors. And in 1719, the General Assembly petitioned the king, just bypassed them, petitioned the king to take over. It took them 10 years to do it, but in 1729, the British government were ruling South Carolina, and the Lord Proprietors were out. And Robert Johnson was made the first governor. Well, during the last years of the Lord Proprietors, when they were worried about keeping their jobs and dealing with other problems, raids by the Spanish and pirates and so forth, a Swiss native, French-speaking Swiss native, by the name of John Pierre Purich, approached them and about him going to Switzerland and bringing back a bunch of people and starting a town and so forth. He had a plan he presented to them, and they rejected it on several occasions. Well, as soon as the English government took over, he was still around waiting. The first thing they did was they approved the plan to establish 11 townships in South Carolina, Orangeburg being one. But he jumped on the bandwagon right quick and said, okay, let me do one and on the Savannah River, and we'll call it after, name it after me, call it Purishburg. And so they accepted his offer. That was in 1730. Let's see. Yeah, and he drew up a plan, a description, but the name of it was A Description of the Province of South Carolina, drawn up in Charlestown in September 1731. And so he had this published in newspapers in Switzerland and circulated as a pamphlet. It was very effective in setting into motion what the previous Golden Book had talked about, but where we didn't yet have any results. And the officials in Europe were, because of the immigration to Pennsylvania and other places, were beginning to question whether they should be losing all these citizens. They were trying to stop it. And they said that these people, after reading his pamphlet, had rabies Carolina. That meant Carolina madness. Other folks said it was a pack of lies and so forth, but in his treatise, he correctly summarized the government's policy of granting land. He told about the 11 townships and all of that. But he commented on a lot of other things. He had heard a number of objections from people about coming over and the hardships and so forth, so he tried to deal with it. This whole pamphlet and two more that I'm going to talk about are all available on our website, ogsgs.org. But I want to quote two things from this, and you could read the whole pamphlet at your leisure. He said, "The lands will not be difficult to clear because there's neither stones nor brambles, but only great trees which do not grow very thick, so that more land may be cleared there in 1 week than could be done in Switzerland in a month." Well, that's a question about how accurate that is. But the one I like best is about rattlesnakes. He wrote, "The serpent is very seldom seen, and if they are met, they do very little hurt. Except when they are provoked to defend themselves. Besides, they never fail to give you notice at their approach by their rattles, which can be heard at a considerable distance." Anyway, that's about rattlesnakes. He taught, there's 9 pages, so there's a lot of information. 2 other promotional pamphlets are available at the website. The first by Hans Jacob Reinsberger, also a Swiss. It was published in 1740. So Purrie's was 1731, now 1740. And it was titled True and Completely Reliable Good News from the English Royal Providence of South Carolina. They like long titles. He had already settled on 300 acres in Saxgoffa and had got the government to approve him as a voluntary agent to go recruit people, go back over and recruit people. And he told in his pamphlet how things were going so well for them that he was leaving his wife and children behind to run the farm, and he was going over to bring folks. I'll just give you one illustration from his pamphlet. He said, arrangements are such that laborers and tradespeople of all sorts and kinds who scarcely know how to make a living in Germany or Switzerland can live in plenty here and in a short time make themselves well-to-do. A great many miserable poor people have already come here and they now live in abundance. So that was his take on being here. Well, then 13 years later, another pamphlet appeared. Actually, it was published in a Swiss almanac, and it was written by Johann Tobler, another native of Switzerland. Seems like the Swiss were doing all the writing here. His 10-page article is much more objective than the others, in that he describes the various towns, including Orangeburg, short paragraph of Orangeburg, government policies, and he talks about the lifestyle of the residents and how the Germans relate to the English and so forth. So it's a great article, 10 pages. One short quote from his. There's no lack of employment to complain about. Whoever can work and wants to work can find things to do so he can earn an honest living by his means. But there are many people who avoid work and prefer to wander around in the woods and support themselves by hunting. However, some of them do earn a great deal doing that. Another means of marketing South Carolina overseas in those days was letters. When you read the letters that survive, many of them are critical of something about the new land. And you wonder why that didn't deter people. I think from what I've read is that the promoters had a better means of getting their letters circulated, whereas the complainers sent it just to a family or friends and it did not get circulated. But some of them say, Mr. Purrie is a big liar. This is terrible. The government policy is terrible. The land in Purrie'sburg especially is terrible. And so there's a lot of negative letters. Let me just show you several books. If you're interested in this subject, this is one about the early immigration. Early immigration, early 18th century Palatine immigration. I'll have them up here if you want to look at them afterwards. Becoming German, that's an interesting title, isn't it? This is about that 1709 group that I told you descended on England and ended up in New York. And what they meant by becoming German, that's an interesting concept, is that there was no German when these people came over. There were individual parts of German, and the only common thing was the language. They had different dietary habits, they had different culture. Some were Lutheran, some were Reformed, And when they got to New York, or Germantown, Pennsylvania, or Orangeburg, all of this melded together, and we call it German. So they became what we call German in this country by bringing all those habits. And then this is a very interesting one, and it emphasizes Pennsylvania, but it's called Trade in Strangers. And it's talking about the economics and how many people came and so forth. Interesting thing is that I didn't know 10 times as many people went to Pennsylvania as came to South Carolina. 10 times as many Germans. And then this one, America Experienced, is about letters from not just our area, but all over. And it has the actual letters in so you can read what they said to each other. In summary, the marketing of South Carolina in the early 1700s really had been established by what was going on with Pennsylvania before the settlement of South Carolina. And this was sort of a foundation for what happened when Mr. Purry and the others started writing their letters specifically about South Carolina. That Golden Book, published in 1706, planted seeds about Carolina. Carolina was known long before this mass immigration occurred. And the three publications I mentioned that are on our website were ones that directly affected what happened in the early and mid-1700s in Orangeburg and the other German areas. So, you see that without our modern means of communications, they found a way to communicate the good features of Carolina. Some were distorted, but they promoted them just like our present-day advertising, emphasizing the good and forgetting the negative. So they sold South Carolina very well to the Germans and the Swiss. And so I'd just like for you to remember that there was real marketing done when the folks over here in South Carolina said to the folks over there, "Y'all come."
Thank you very much, Billy. That was quite interesting. Does anybody have any questions for Billy? Are you open to taking questions for a couple minutes? Anybody got any questions? Yes?
Is there anything in those books about what it was really like for them to sell everything and actually leave?
You might want to rephrase the question so everybody can hear it before you answer.
I think I understood you to say that what was it like for the people to leave over there and sell everything. I haven't found anything to describe that situation. It's just my own imagination, and I looked at my own family that I wrote about in the book. And in his case, his parents were dead, and he had one sibling that was living. And so I think in that case, it probably made it easier than if he had a large family over there that he was leaving. But I don't think there was any question about it that they knew it was a one-way trip. And the governments made it difficult because they taxed them. They had to pay a tax when they left. In most cases, now there were some that said, I read somewhere where one person said, "I don't owe you any tax for this," and so he just slipped off during the night and went down to Rotterdam. But it had to be a very soul-searching, trying situation. One of the things that some people try to do when they write about their ancestors is they try to, number one, make them make them out to be rich, wealthy, successful folks over there. Or they come over for religious reasons, really noble reasons. Well, neither one of those are true for most of our people. First of all, if you're wealthy over there, you wouldn't leave your family and come and give up everything, sell everything you have, and come over here to an unknown situation. I mean, you just wouldn't do that. And all the research indicates that in Germany and Switzerland, the basic way the religion was determined for a given area was that the rulers decided what it would be. But even when he did that, he didn't exclude the others. What he did is he took the church building and gave them to the one he favored, and might even pay the pastors, and the others were on their own. But they didn't prohibit. For example, in the area of the where the Palatines came in the late 1600s, where for 150 years it had been reformed, evangelical reformed religion. They got a ruler in the late 1600s who said, "We're going to be Catholic." And he started to apparently get pretty tough with the other religious groups. But his neighboring princes were Protestant. So they put a little bit of pressure on him, and in 1706 he issued a religious freedom edict, which probably helped over in this country because of that principle had been established. So even though the churches remained Catholic, others were free to worship based on this edict that he proposed. And then the big church in Sennhausen, in Heidelberg, excuse me, which Sennhausen is a little suburb of Heidelberg. In the church there, they put a petition down the center of the church. The Catholics worshiped on one side, the Protestants on the other, at the same time. And this went on for a long, long period of time. Any other question?
Who are the authors of the books that you mentioned?
I'll show them to you. Okay, thank you.
Lynn?
Just one of the things from one of those books, America Experience, I thought people might enjoy. I have wondered for years. The America Experience is really worth reading for these letters. How do these people react to leaving the Alps and all the gorgeous mountain scenery, and they get dumped into poor old swamps? You read these things at these letters home, and there's one wonderful quote. "You must come. It is so wonderful. It's so flat. You don't need brakes on your flat."
Yeah, another point that the introduction to that book makes is that two people coming together, for example, a husband and wife, have basically the same physical experience of leaving and moving to a new country and could have totally opposite reactions to it. One may consider it life's greatest adventure, and the other one may consider it life's worst experience. So a lot of it depended on the personality of the individual, too, as to how they reacted. But all good things to think about when we study our ancestors. Thank you very much for that, Bill.